the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good Monday morning, and thanks for starting off your work week with us here at Farm City Newsday. It's the beginning of a new month, and we have collected a list of events for growers to attend, including seminars, meetings, and field days. But there is one particular workshop I'd like to highlight. If you want to learn more about the Market Facilitation Program and if your operation qualifies, this month there are four up and down the state. The first workshop is happening today in Chico, on the 11th in Fresno, on the 15th in Bakersfield, and back up north in Modesto on the 16th. Visit our website at agnetwest.com for more information, or you can always sign up for our weekly e-newsletter to stay in the know. Moving on to what's happening in today's show, Brian German is talking with us about ongoing research projects from the Citrus Research Board. You'll hear about organic growers receiving pressure from produce purchasers. Taylor Hillman has details on a walnut snacking opportunity with the New Japan deal. And I'm starting off the show today with news on trade with the European Union. Let's jump right in. First it was China, and now the U.S. is implementing tariffs on EU products, thus widening another trade war. Now, you may see a hike in price on your dinner bill, as the U.S. announced last week tariffs on European Union food products. The announcements of the tariffs came after a World Trade Organization win, where the U.S. won the largest arbitration award in WTO history of $7.5 billion in a dispute over illegal subsidies on large aircrafts. This addition of new tariffs expands a trade war with the European Union, and the new tariffs could take effect as early as October 18th. The duties will be applied to hundreds of imports from EU member states, with the bulk of the tariffs being applied to imports from France, Germany, Spain, and the United Kingdom. Those four countries are responsible for the illegal subsidies. The U.S. will impose a 25% tariff on food products, including French wine, Scotch, and Italian cheese. The U.S. will also place a 10% tariff on large civil aircraft products and another 25% tariff on coffee and some tools and machinery from Germany. USTR does have the authority to apply 100% tariff on affected products and the authority to increase the tariffs at any time or change the products affected. But according to Reuters, the U.S. Trade Representative's office said it would, quote, continually reevaluate these tariffs based on our discussions with the EU, and expects to enter talks in a bid to resolve the dispute. NAFB did contribute to this report. And now for more on trade, here's Taylor Hillman with another report.
The new trade deal with Japan will create snacking opportunities for California walnuts. A unilateral trade agreement between the U.S. and Japan is now official, and California walnut producers should be especially excited. California Walnut Commission Senior International Marketing Director Pamela Gravier said they've been waiting for this tariff to be reduced, and it will open up snacking opportunities that California walnuts haven't had in Japan before.
Sure, actually, we're very excited that walnuts is specifically included in this deal. And what it will do is it will offer some new opportunities in the Japanese market for food manufacturing, menu development, as well as snack packaging, because when the tariffs go away, the pricing becomes more stable, and it offers tremendous opportunities.
Reporting for AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Taylor Hillman.
As the popularity of organic produce increases, some growers are feeling pressure from retailers. President and owner of Kings River Produce, Steve Beck, said the requests from produce purchasers for some of the large box retailers are creating some challenges.
They keep twisting us down to really get our margins really low, yet they're also requiring us to do additional things for food safety, for crop rotations, not necessarily crop rotations, but things that they're not allowing us to do. They don't want us to cover crop. They don't like us to use any kind of animal-based soil amendments. Some of the companies are requiring us not to be able to use beneficial habitats in our field, but these companies are now requiring us not to allow us to plant these beneficial habitats because they could be a harbor for a vertebrate pest, which is an issue with food safety. So they're requiring us almost to grow in a monoculture organically, which traditionally it's not going to work that way.
The Citrus Research Board is continuing its work to address the most problematic issues for the industry. Chief Research Scientist for CRB, Dr. Melinda Klein, noted some of the more than 50 ongoing projects they're involved in.
We've got a range of new variety development that we're working on, both bringing in some of the Australian relatives that seem to show some tolerance. That's ongoing traditional breeding efforts, as well as some GM efforts to see if there's particular genes that can provide tolerance. In our vector diseases, we've got a range of projects. There's a lot of work, again, on antimicrobials, understanding different proteins or gene fragments that could help inhibit the growth of the bacteria. And, of course, we still have work ongoing at UC Riverside looking at the canines. And CRB is actually involved in an HIV MAC grant that's going to be working to bring canines out to California this coming fiscal year.
For AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Brian German.
Deere announces layoffs amid demand declines. NAFB reports Deere & Company this week announced indefinite layoffs amid demand woes. Deere officials say more than 160 U.S. workers at agriculture machinery facilities in Illinois and Iowa will be laid off after the company last week announced it would reduce production by 20%. Reuters says Deere, the world's largest farm equipment maker, is reeling from the fallout of the U.S.-China trade war that has slowed purchases from farmers. The layoffs include roughly 50 workers at the Harvester Works facility in East Moline, Illinois, and more than 100 workers at the Davenport Works facility in Davenport, Iowa. Deere also lowered its income forecast to $3.2 billion in August from the previous forecast in February, set at $3.6 billion. In an August earnings report, Deere explained market concerns forced farmers to postpone major equipment purchases. Deere has also said it expects industry sales of agriculture equipment to be about the same as last year in the United States and Canada, which accounts for 60% of its overall business. The Association of Equipment Manufacturers, in its monthly equipment sales reports for August, reported that overall sale numbers are flat to positive for the year, but the industry, quote, remains cautious about the overall ag economy. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
October is National Farm to School Month, and the California Department of Food and Agriculture's Office of Farm to Fork will be highlighting the work of the Farm to School program all month long. The CDFA F2F Farm to School program seeks to develop connections between students and agriculture through three main objectives: helping to get healthy California-grown produce served in school lunches across the state, educating California students about food and agriculture in cafeterias and classrooms, and encouraging new learning opportunities for students such as school gardens, FFA, and culinary programs. Based on community feedback, CDFA F2F Farm to School is focusing more on increasing school district investments in agriculture-related opportunities and creating school district collaboratives to coordinate education in classrooms and cafeterias and aiding professional development opportunities for food service staff members in schools. For AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Brian German.
Well, in today's livestock news, for 2020, dairy producers can sign up for coverage under the Dairy Margin Coverage, or DMC, program starting today, October 7th. Now, producers who locked in coverage in the 2019 sign-up must certify the operation is producing and commercially marketing milk and then pay their annual administrative fee during the 2020 enrollment period. So here we are just a week and a half after the deadline for the 2019 DMC enrollment. Producers can now sign up for the 2020 program, and some wonder about that. With more on this story, here's Rod Bang.
Now, some dairy growers might ask, didn't we just finish a DMC enrollment period just last month? Steve Peterson of the Agriculture Department's Farm Service Agency says yes for the 2019 calendar year.
Because we're trying to run the program on a calendar year basis, we're going to be looking at moving forward to 2020 sign up under the Dairy Margin Coverage Program.
And Steve, the dates for sign up for next year's Dairy Margin Coverage period?
Sign up will begin October the 7th and will run through December the 13th.
The 2020 DMC sign-up dates are not just about getting the program enrollment period straight on the calendar.
Ultimately, we want to make certain that producers have the ability to take advantage of figuring out what their options are before the next calendar year to do it more timely for 2020.
Now, one important difference between dairy margin coverage enrollment of 2019 versus 2020, No retroactive dairy margin coverage for next year.
2019 is unusual because producers really had up until September to see what those dairy margins were going to be, what those differences were going to be, to see whether they were in the money or not. Starting with the 2020 year, sign up will be in advance of the actual calendar year and knowing what those margins will be by month.
Yet Steve Peterson says dairy producers can still utilize the online decision support tool, as they did for 2019, to make coverage choices for 2020.
Producers can go in and look at projections. They can determine what the premium costs are going to be. This tool was developed with the University of Wisconsin and funded by the Office of the Chief Economist. And it's a really good tool for producers to go in and determine options, what coverage levels they should look at based on price projections that are being estimated. So it's a way to really get some information associated to what might be best for them.
More details about dairy margin coverage are available at local Farm Service Agency offices and online at the Dairy Margin Coverage webpage at www.farmers.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. Of course, DMC does offer catastrophic coverage at no cost to the producer other than the annual $100 administrative fee, but producers can opt for greater coverage levels for a premium in addition to the administrative fee. At the time to sign up, you can choose between the $4 all the way up to the $9.50 coverage level. If you like more information, you can go to the Farm Service Agency website. That's fsa.usda.gov. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
Stephanie Fu with USDA's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion says there are tools to help consumers figure out what and how much to eat.
When you go to myplate.gov, there is a whole range of resources. You can find out how much you need personally from each of the food groups.
She says MyPlate is a symbol that people can personalize to their own needs.
If I prefer to eat broccoli, you know, broccoli and cauliflower and spinach. That's how I'm going to get my vegetables on any particular day. But you may prefer eating sweet potatoes and other things. So you can pick and choose based on what you like and start from there to make sure that you're getting what you need every day.
Meanwhile, she encourages people to eat healthy, but also to eat well.
Food is something that we all should enjoy. We all need it, but it's also something that would be nice to enjoy.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Blue eyes crying in the rain.
Hello, everybody out there in farm country. The radio commentary is brought to you by the National Corn Growers Association, Crop Life America, and the Renewable Fuels Association. They are friends, supporters, and allies of a healthy farm economy in prosperous rural America. And now for today's commentary. I'll be on the farm in Illinois later in the week. We haven't harvested any corn or beans yet, but it's time to get started. When I look out over our fields, I can't help but think about the roller coaster ride it has been over the years. Prices up, then down, surplus, then a shortage. Here's a headline in the Wall Street Journal, November 28, 1980. That's almost 40 years ago. And it says, big income prices loom as world demands more food. The experts then were afraid that we wouldn't be able to feed the people in future yields. But look what happened. With all the new technology, we have a global surplus. Prices are down because we have too much food. I don't expect the world to run short of food. If the market economy raises prices, we'll find a way to produce more. Okay, now with the time left today, I want to talk about bioengineered salmon. G salmon should be coming to the market soon. It has taken 20 years for Aqua Bounty, a small company, to put its GE salmon on the market. The Food and Drug Administration ruled in 2015 that the fish is safe to eat. And there is no nutritional differences between GE and conventional salmon. GE salmon is able to grow twice as fast, consumes less food than Atlantic salmon. 90% of salmon consumed in the United States is imported. We need some farm-raised GE salmon. And after the FDA ruled GE salmon to be safe, it took Aqua Bounty 3 years to get labeling approval. Alaskan Senator Murkowski would like to force more delay. She says GE salmon is an unhealthy frankenfood. Well, I think the members of Congress should respect the findings of the FDA. Canada has already approved GE salmon, but we can't get our act together. I guess I'm not surprised that Congress can't get anything done. And I am John Block from Washington, and next week I'll be on the farm.
Making your own olive oil, that's coming up on This Land of Ours. One great raw product you can make yourself is olive oil. The most common type of olive used for cold pressing is the green olive, but always pick them fresh. Olives that are overripened will create an oil that will spoil, so never use canned olives. You'll need several pieces of equipment to get started, including a grinding mechanism like a millstone, an immersion blender, anything weighty such as heavy wood, cinder blocks, or books, a surface to press and collect pumice upon, holding containers for the separation, and dark green bottles and a funnel. Although it may seem like a long list of supplies, many of these will be a once-off purchase which you can use again and again. Typically, extra virgin olive oil is made at large mills by a method called cold pressing. Basically, olives are pressed through a machine and oils are collected while the rest of the olive is discarded. Cold pressing eliminates the use of heat to extract oils. Thus, it's considered an unrefined oil. All the good stuff is left intact. Speaking of good stuff, the healthful benefits of making your own olive oil, they're full of beneficial antioxidants, anti-inflammatory properties, and antimicrobial properties. They also include monounsaturated fats, which are the good fats. I'm Kathy Isom for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West, and welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. So this recipe today is really not a recipe, more than a technique, but it's a technique that so many places get wrong. Now, I can't stress enough how important it is to properly sear a steak. So this is my recipe for a perfect seared herb-crusted steak. I promise you, this is something you're really, really going to want to learn and listen to this, because for a long time, we've been doing things the wrong way. This specific way has never, ever did me wrong, and I get compliments all the times on my meat. What am I doing different? How is it this way? It's very, very simple. It's really a technique, and it's a technique that I want to share with you. So listen up, because we are getting started now. The very first thing I'm doing is I'm taking 4 cuts of beef. Now, you can have the beef pre-cooked. And I know that sounds kind of crazy, but you really can. I love cooking sous vide. There is not a thing in the world that I don't put in a vacuum sealer and an immersion circulated water oven. So I absolutely love this recipe. Now, it's different for a lot of people only because if you don't have this kind of equipment, you're probably wondering, how can I get the same result? And honestly, if you were to take a piece of meat and you were to cook it in the oven, slow and low, and I would say, honestly, like, let's say, for example, a prime rib or even a regular, just a nice cut of steak, 4 ounce cut of steak is always what I consider to be more than appropriate. Anything over that is just a lot of meat, and it's very hard to digest meat. Remember, it takes about 6 days to digest a 4 ounce cut of steak. So remember to eat in proportion, but more importantly, you want to have great flavor. It's not the quantity, it's the quality. So get a great cut. Now, I cook mine sous vide to medium rare. Once my beef is medium rare, now I can put on that perfect crust that everybody absolutely loves that I do. So what I do is I take 2 tablespoons of vegetable oil and I put that into about a large to medium sized pan. I want this to be a nonstick pan, preferably. Now I put my oil in, and what I'm going to do next is I'm going to decorate the bottom of the pan, not the steak, but the bottom of the pan. I want those flavors to be caramelized and gorgeous.
2 tablespoons of vegetable goes into that pan, 2 tablespoons of dry chives, 1 tablespoon of lemon pepper, salt and pepper all over the pan, and then I'm going to carefully, only on one side, going to put my steaks down and get a nice crust on there. Usually takes about 3 to 4 minutes. Now remember, only on one side. There's a misconception that we're supposed to season both sides of the meat. That is not true. Allow it, once I put the crust on it, to rest for about 5 minutes and enjoy. I'm Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. I'm Danielle Leo. For our interview segment today, we take a listen to that brand new agriculture podcast we heard on Friday, which was hosted by American Farm Bureau President Zippy Duvall. In that episode, Zippy talked with Secretary Sonny Perdue. The two of them talked about being Georgia farm boys and how it led them to Washington. Here's the remaining portion of their chat.
What about your mission here at USDA? I mean, my mission at American Farm Bureau has been, what I wanted to do was bring a feeling of service back to our states, because they're the ones that deal with our grassroots of our organization, our 6 million members right back there. And I wanted to bring transparency and inclusiveness. I wanted what we were doing at American Farm Bureau to get back to our grassroots, to let them realize what a valuable organization it was to have one voice speaking for agriculture. But I wanted to make sure everybody felt inclusive, not just women and men, but different kinds of agriculture, traditional, organic, and big, small, west, east, north, south. You know, I wanted them to feel that inclusiveness so that we could truly have a one voice. And that we continue to work on that culture, but, you know, it's been here 100 years now, and that mission has really served the 3 years that I've served as president well. So your mission here at USDA.
I think you learned that in Georgia, Zippy. My recollection is that you elevated the Georgia Farm Bureau to an advocacy organization for agriculture, that to a new level of respect and mutual respect, but also a mutual advocacy for its members in all sorts of agriculture and agribusiness there that was good for the economy of Georgia. Agriculture is still the number one industry in Georgia, and I thought Farm Bureau represented the breadth and depth of agriculture extremely well. And I think you brought those same skills to the American Federation here by understanding that we're one huge tent. There are a lot of things going on, and it is absolutely tremendous. I like to say that it's a blessing to live in a country where we're the superpower of food, and we were dependent on energy for other places sometime, yeah. And that brought a lot of turmoil. Can you imagine what kind of turmoil there would be if we were dependent on somebody else for our food, for our people? So that's why USDA is so important. It's much broader, deeper, wider, more impactful than I ever imagined.
So, Sonny, when I think back over my career as a farmer, and there are probably a handful of men that meant so much to me in my young life. My feed man, where he'd carry me when I couldn't make all my feed payments, or a fertilizer dealer that send me one bill a year because he, on a handshake, he says, as long as you pay me everything you owe me before January 1, I won't nag you. And those men taught me things, and my dad. I mean, I can't, of course, either one of us can say anything without what your dad did for you. And, you know, Daddy said, you know, I'll make it where you can pay for this farm and make a living here, but I won't give you anything. You're eventually going to pay for it all. Right. You know, so those are things that we learned in life. And through those men and God's leadership, we diversified on our farm and was able to survive the 80s, which is terrible, and we're in something now that kind of matches to that. So I'd like to talk about the opportunities in agriculture in 2019, because I know there's a lot of young people out there listening to us, and you and I see each other a lot at 4-H meetings and FFA meetings, and both of us like the green and the blue and gold, and they represent the future of our industry. I'd like to hear what the Secretary of Agriculture of the United States thinks about the opportunities in agriculture.
Zippy, it may seem like it's a strange time to say this, but I don't think there's been a better time to be involved in agriculture. I know we got a lot of challenges. We got to get this trade disruption resolved. But the new technology coming on, precision agriculture, I call it the digitalization of agriculture. The new sensor technology, the kind of optics that we're going to use, robotic milking machines, those kind of things. We're on the cusp, I think, of almost a fourth generation revolution of agriculture in a way with much technology. And we are harvesting the benefit of technology we built on, farmers' hard work, but the creative innovations that are coming are just absolutely amazing. I'm stunned by them. They're things that are on the shelf right now that are going to increase productivity in an amazing way. And we just need to get through this period of time. That's why it takes that faith and optimism for farmers to hang on during these periods of time. It is tough for young people. It's tough for people who have been in the business in equity. Nobody likes the economic stress and duress, but it does make us tougher and more resilient. But I don't think there's a better time to be involved in agriculture than today. We got a hungry world coming on with almost 10 billion people in not very many years. They're all going to want to eat. And the United States of America is blessed to be the superpower of food for the world. And the world is depending on us, and we need to be there to make sure they can count on us.
I totally agree with what you said. And there are young people, just like I said, listening to us. And then there's probably some people out there that's not involved in agriculture. And some of that technology scares them. It makes them wonder about their food and how it's produced and makes them suspicious. You know, it's, I always say, you know, people aren't scared of technology when it comes to health or their phone and communication and all that. But when it comes to agriculture, they say, whoa, wait a minute. What are you saying to people to make them feel comfortable with that?
Well, again, I think we just have to go back to the basic science. The fact is that we don't find anybody that's been harmed by the innovations in agriculture that way. There's been a lot of internet chatter about GMO organizations and all that, but science will prove that they're safe there. The kind of crop protection chemicals we use, it's really a litigation kind of issue, but there's safety in that. We have fed our own country and the world based on these innovations. And if we think the choice is not using these and going back to being hungry for the world, you just need to look at how the United States has helped raise the world out of poverty in so many places because of the technology of agriculture. And it would be a shame to allow unsound science or fear-mongering to take over and let us not make the kind of progress we can to feed this growing, hungry world.
And that's a job we all got to take on to be able to inform people as to what that's about. Young people, you know, if they're sitting out there today and they're trying to decide whether or not they want to be part of agriculture, you know, I think about all the time they spend on their phones and their tablets and video games. And a lot of that technology in agriculture is going right down that avenue of the things that they're doing at home in their spare time, and they could take it into their adult time and be able to use that technology and experience there. So,
and some of those kids are creating new tools and apps for agriculture that are going to be beneficial.
Sure.
As we look at how we can do things better and more productively.
A while ago, you mentioned, I don't want to get through this discussion without going back and touching on this. You mentioned you and I had been traveled the country, and sometimes I was following you, and sometimes you was following me, and we've traveled together. So I'd like to talk about what's been your favorite place. I remember going out west and hitting Arizona, Utah, and Idaho in the same trip out there. Spent a little over a week out there, and they flew me around in a little plane. I got to fly over the federal lands. I got to go to the border and see the end of the fence. I got to see the unbelievable beauty of Idaho. And then my next special place that I've been introduced to is upstate New York. You know, you think of New York, think of New York City, but upstate New York is absolutely beautiful. And the agricultures in those areas are so important to America and so vibrant. But I think they grabbed my interest because what I knew was Southern agriculture.
Right.
And what I still love it, but the newness of that has captured my attention as a Easterner.
You ask a question a lot of journalists ask, and I think I finally come to a comfortable answer. My favorite place is the last place I was because there are just so many areas across the country, and you mentioned several of them that we've been exposed to and broadened our vision of all the things that this country has. You just think about the blessings of a bounty that we have in the United States of America from in that song, God Bless America, from the oceans to the prairies to all over. It's gorgeous. I probably can't think about agriculture without thinking about California and that valley and just amazing agricultural capacity there in that that valley in California. The Rose Farm down by Luke Air Force Base in Arizona, the types of things, the greenhouse in Connecticut that way that you mentioned, sitting on Ed Davidian's front porch and outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Those are great memories. It was really important for me to get around all over the state, as it was you, all over the country, I think, in order to demonstrate that we had a broader vision, not just going to be focused on Southeast, but we wanted to understand agriculture in so many ways, in so many places, because it is different. The people are the same, but the cropping systems and crops and others. I was out with Congressman Newhouse and those waving wheat fields in Washington, and those, I can't believe it, Zippy, how they combine that on 30-40% slopes out there.
Right.
It's just it's a gorgeous type of thing that I just feel so blessed to have been exposed to.
Again, you can hear this full podcast by visiting www.fb.org/podcast. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. Natural resource conservation advocates believe continued promotion of conservation practices in agriculture can be fostered through incentives to landowners. Here's USDA Rod Bain with a report.
Incentivizing conservation agriculture has been a concept developing into practical application for some time. So how to further advance an ecosystem marketplace and the potential value and benefits to both producers and the environment?
If you're going to make meaningful contributions to carbon sequestration, water quality, reductions in agriculture use of water, water conservation measures, soil health, all of those things, you have to incentivize and create the opportunity for that to occur on private lands.
That's Natural Resources Conservation Service Acting Associate Chief Kevin Norton, among those discussing the topic at a recent Farm Foundation forum. He says no matter the conservation model or tools used, producers must understand both economic and environmental value and benefits are measured in the long term.
And it may not be a value that is realized in this year. Some of the conservation benefits starts today, but it accrues over multiple years.
Norton goes on to explain the long-term investment needed in farm conservation efforts, particularly in seeing both environmental and economic benefits.
A lot of the conservation is every acre of the farm is invested in conservation, and they may start in one place and it may take 3, 4, or 5 years to get across the entire operation. You cannot always do all of your conservation work or have that investment across your operation in one single year. So it's a long-term investment that yields rewards, but it takes conservation planning, conservation technical assistance to bring that to the private lands.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgNetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgNetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City News Day by AgNet West.